extremely well for a minute or two. Having spent much of the night completing the tricky hydro-digito techniques of the unit's equivalent of the moonwalk, at about noon, the nurse and I, she working a double shift out of compassion for this poor, salvageable woman, were accosted by the husband, who got real red in the face and said, "I think you're both incredibly callous for keeping my poor wife alive." The nurse burst into tears. I, in agreement with the husband, fell silent. The nurse and I stood there with the dying woman who stank of disinfectant and infection and bilirubin and ammonia until the husband had done his punch-drunk catharting and left. For a few minutes I felt as if I were on the edge of some disaster, some abyss that seemed familiar from a nightmare. Then it passed, and again I felt calm. From noon until I left, I was to work in my outpatient clinic downstairs. With some apprehension, I left my unit and entered the hopelessly inefficient world of the rest of the House of God. As I was going into my office, I ran into Chuck going into his. He looked even worse than usual. "Well, man," he said, "bad news. I've been found out."
"Found out? Found out what?"
"Well, you know how I always had the amazing luck that the old ladies would never seem to show up at my clinic, no matter what appointments they made?"
"Yeah, it was amazing," I said.
"Well, the reason they never showed up was they was dead."
"Dead?"
"Uh-huh. Dead. See, I used to go over to the record room and pull charts, use dead names for appointments. Hardly any of them showed. My own clinic was ridiculous. I employed a useful anatomical concept for clinic medicine, called Scruffy's rhomboid space, which was formed by unbuttoning the fourth button down on the shirt or blouse, forming a diamond-shaped opening for my stethoscope. With clever wrist action, the stethoscope could be rotated and pushed in such a way that all major organs could be examined without having the patient undress. Using this technique, I waded through my familiar patients with their trivial complaints, my mind filled with the precision and elegance of the techniques of the unit, like popping a steel needle into a virginal radial artery. My outpatients seemed wary of me, and many of them kept asking me if I was sure I felt all right. I told them I was feeling extremely well. One in particular, my basketballing Jehovah's Witness, was insistent.
"Why, Dr. Bash, you never for months used that stethoscope on me. We allus used to just talk. I knows in my heart that there's something gone wrong. What is it?"
I told her there was nothing wrong, and finished examining her. Shaking her head, she left. I muttered to myself as I walked through the fresh April afternoon toward the Humbler. All this education just to write prescriptions for padded bras with pockets? What the hell was I in, anyway? Ladies' lingerie? The gaily colored marathoners began to pass. The first, the leaders, looked fit and eager, even after these 20 miles, even facing the terror of the Humbler. The build of the leaders was like that of Pincus, thin to the waist, solid below. They ran through waves of applause. How jealous I was! The blur of color went on, and after about 500 had gone by, there came Pincus, in a determined, sure style that might well bring him in under 3 hours. I shouted, "Go get him, Pincus!" And he looked up, without waving or smiling, and trudged on up the Humbler, with calm, deliberate strides. He looked good. He was doing extremely well, and I watched him go wistfully, the gotta-have-heart on his rear end disappearing over the crest. My man Pincus hadn't even broken stride. The Humbler? Ha! Later that evening, at the high school gym, after playing some hoop, I ran into a unit nurse whose name I'd always forgotten and couldn't recall then. Wearing a tight black danskin, she was working out with weights. I was surprised and delighted with her body, and with her interest in her body. Dripping sweat, we chatted. I asked her out for a drink, In the bar, we watched Nixon, who, even though Haig thought that Nixon didn't sell on TV anymore, had gone ahead with a primetime TV address from the Oval Office. Something about edited transcripts of the tapes. The packaging was terrific. On a side table, to which the camera intermittently panned, were shiny black vinyl binders, each embossed with a gold presidential seal.
"I am placing my trust in the basic fairness of the American people."
Nuzzling the nurse's sweaty neck, I said, "Damn good idea. It's about time. Get the goddamn thing straightened out once and for all." To me, the locker room aroma of this tough nurse was more enticing than perfume. I loved it. After the drink, before the bedding, she went with me to an all-night sporting goods store, where I bought myself my first-ever fishing rod and reel. Chapter 22. Having done extremely well in the unit, it was difficult for me to say goodbye. I felt sad. I wanted to stay on. How do astronauts say goodbye? As befit a pro, my goodbyes were unemotional. Neil Armstrong saying goodbye to Frank Borman. John Ehrlichman saying goodbye to Robert Bob Haldeman. Goodbye to Pincus, my hero, who had run 2 hours, 57 minutes, 34 seconds, and who said, "Cardiology can be very rewarding in financial and personal terms, and with the implementation of hobbies, a very healthful life. Think about it, Roy. You're a young man with a bright future." I left. Later that afternoon, Barry and I, R.O.R., were driving out into the countryside to relax. I was reading a letter from my father. "Your experience undoubtedly is stimulating, and I am sure that you are totally absorbed. Soon it will be over, and you will have to decide about your future life." "You know," I said to Barry, "after all these years of disagreement with him, I finally think he's right." We sat on the edge of a park, the spring blushing chaotically all around us. The swath of green, lush with a fresh rain, swept across in front of us. From the pond, reflecting the mansion on the left, past the 100-year-old oak under which the wasps held their weddings, to the old stone wall, and in back of it, the symmetric and rooted old houses. A dog came up to play, dropping a twig closer and closer until I threw it, and he chased it. After a while I got tired, and he sensed it, and left. My mind, like a missile, kept homing to the unit. On the drive back I felt restless, and Barry noticed and asked, "What's the matter, Roy? You're done with the hardest part of the year." "I know. I miss it. It's hard to relax. Even fishing would be easier than this. Did I tell you I bought a rod and reel? You know, I need your help. With your psychological expertise, maybe you could tell me how I can change." "Change what?" "My personality. I want to go from type A to type B." Barry didn't comment. We separated, planning to meet again that night. We had tickets to see Marcel Marceau. I was restless. I missed something. I was not doing well. I didn't want Marcel Marceau. I wanted the unit. It would be strange if I went back there tonight, my first night off, after I had finished. But wait, Joe had done it. My first day there, she'd spent the night with Mrs. Peedley. I would do it too. Under the guise of concern for the old lady in VTAC, I would go and spend the night on the unit. It wasn't until the hermetic doors slushed shut behind me and I heard the ethereal, "Around the world in 80 days, and I settled into a chair in Peedley's room, that I felt calm again. This calm was not to last. Barry appeared, dressed to kill, and said, "Roy, what the hell are you doing here? We're supposed to see Marcel Marceau. You bought the tickets, remember?" "Here, feel this," I said, indicating my gastrox. "What about Marcel Marceau?" "Inoperative." "All right, Roy. It's either this or me. Take your pick." I heard myself say, "It's this." That's what I thought you'd say, said Barry. And I don't buy it, 'cause you're sick.
She made a motion out into the hallway, and in walked the two policemen, Gilheeny and Quick. Following them were Chuck and the Runt.
A good evening to you from the depths of my nervous stomach, said the redhead, limping in. We have not seen you since you became a red-hot intern in this weird unit.
We have missed you, said Quick. Finton here, with his bollocks leg, cannot pursue your company as once he could.
What the hell are you doing here? I asked suspiciously.
Your girlfriend said that you have been crazy, and were refusing to leave this unit and go to the show with her, said Gilheeny.
I'm not going, I said. It's ROR with her and me. Face it. We're through.
Hey, man, said Chuck. You don't want to stay here with these pitiful patients. You're done with this unit shit. Get out. Get on down.
They're not pitiful. They're salvageable.
Roy, said the Runt, you're acting like a donkey.
Thanks a lot, my fair-weather friends. I'm staying here. None of you can understand me anymore. Please leave me alone.
Trespassing is an offense, said Gilheeny, and so we shall remove you. Boys, let's begin.
With a good deal of furious struggling and cursing on my part, under Gilheeny's direction, Quick, Chuck, the Runt, and Barry hoisted me up and carried me out, ushered me down the stairs, and helped me into the police car, which, sirens blaring, raced through the downtown traffic and delivered Barry and me to the theater door. I sat there. Bullshit. While I thought I'd escape when left alone with Barry, once again I had underestimated these policemen.
"You're coming in with us?" I asked, amazed.
"We are admirers of true genius," said Gilheeny. "And true is the genius of M. Marceau, a Jew of the French Catholic denomination, combining the better attributes of both."
"How the hell did you get tickets on such short notice?"
"Graft," said Quick simply.
With Barry and me sandwiched tightly between the bulky Gilheeny and the sinewy Quick, I realized I was trapped, and I resigned myself to sitting there until intermission. I watched as the lights dimmed and the mime began. At first I was indifferent, my mind on the unit. And yet, as Marceau went on, with Barry pressing my hand and the policeman reacting with all the spontaneity of kids, I couldn't help getting interested. The first mime was the balloon seller, giving a free balloon to a child who, clutching it in his hand, is floated up and up out of sight. Everyone around me laughed. On my left I heard a chortle, erupting into a roar, and I realized from the smell of fat and sweat from a uniform that it came from Gilheeny. A hefty elbow slammed into my ribs, and the redhead turned to me, flashed his huge hippo smile, and screamed, flooding me with onions and hash. I laughed. Next, a mime I'd seen Marceau do in England. In 30 seconds he walked through the successive stages of youth, maturity, old age, and death. I sat, hushed, with the others, touched, enthralled, as we recognized our lives ebbing past us in a matter of seconds. Blasts of applause crackled through the theater. I looked at Quick. Tears were in his eyes. All of a sudden, I felt as if a hearing aid for all my senses had been turned on. I was flooded with feeling. I roared. And along with this burst of feeling came a plunging, desperate, clawing plunge down an acrid chasm toward despair. What the hell had happened to me? Something in me had died. Sadness welled up in my gut and burned out through the slits of my eyes. A handkerchief was placed in my hand. I blew my nose. I felt a hug. The last mime skewered me. The mask maker switched back and forth, a smiling mask, a crying mask. Faster and faster, until finally the smiling mask got stuck on his face, and he couldn't remove it. The human struggle, the frantic effort to be rid of a suffocating mask, trapped, writhing, wearing a smile.
The theater erupted. 10 encores. 12. "Bravo! Bravo!" we screamed, and flowed out with the rejuvenated crowd. I blinked, confused. Inside me, all was chaos. My calm had been the calm of death. More than anything, I wanted to jackboot Pincus in his plump pink soleus. Thank God for Barry, for my Orthodox Samaritans, my policemen. As we parted from them, Gilhini, touched, said, "Good night, friend Roy. We'd been worried that we'd lost you." "We've seen it happen before to interns," said Quick, "and if it had happened to you, it would have been a singular loss. God bless." Later, Barry welcomed me back to her, and I felt her caring arms around me as if for the first time. Awakening, I began to thaw. I began to feel a trickle, then a rush of feeling that was scary and overwhelming. Choked up, I began to talk. On and on into the night I talked about the things I'd blotted out. The theme, over and over, coating my bedroom walls with a grayish-white mottled skin, was death. I talked about the horror of the dying and the horror of the dead. Guiltily, I told her about injecting the KCL into Saul. She couldn't hide her shock. How could I have done that? Even if my head told me, yes, it had been for the best, my heart cried out, no, I hadn't done it for him, for the humanity of it. No. Angrily, to shut him up and to get back at them. I'd done it for me. I'd killed a human being. How that phrase would haunt me, tail me like an Israeli agent, a Nazi, search me out when I was least suspecting, clamor after me in sleepy tropical courtyards of my new life where I'd thought that I'd found peace. Finding me, it would accuse me, and I would say, I must have been out of control, crazy. Coldly, rightly, it would say, that can be no excuse. I talked on about the families of the patients in the unit, coming in, searching my eyes for hope. What had I done? I'd done everything I could to avoid them. I had been as far from the world of humans as I could get. Disgusted, I talked about how, in the face of suffering, I'd been professionally nonchalant, where compassion had been needed more desperately than any medicine, I had been sarcastic. I'd avoided feeling everything, as if feelings were little grenades blasting off a fingernail, a toe, a fragment of a heart. Tears in my eyes, I asked Barry, "Where have I been?" "Regressed. I thought I'd lost you for good." "Why? Why did I get like that?" "The more the hurt, the more the fantasied need for defenses. Potts's death rocked you. You imagined yourself to be so fragile you wouldn't let yourself grieve. Like a 2-year-old scared of the dark, you locked onto rituals, your machines, your crazy idolization of Pincus, to protect you." She was right. Since Potts's suicide, all of us had gone around like zombies, stunned, numb, too scared to cry. Each of us had been strung out, trying to save ourselves, fighting against going really psychotic like Eddie, or really killing ourselves by leaping from real buildings and splattering on a real parking lot 8 stories below. We knew that it could have been any of us. Lethal, this becoming and being a doctor. Denying hope and fear, ritualized defenses pulled up around ears like turtlenecks, these doctors, to survive, had become machines, sealed off from humans, from wives, kids, parents, from the warmth of compassion and the thrill of love. I realized that it wasn't just that they'd kept on riding Potts about the yellow man, no. They'd ignored his suffering, his months of fatal depression. And because I felt helpless and didn't know what to do, I'd ignored it too. This internship, this whole training, it destroys people. Yes, it's a disease. The kind of stress you're under, unless you can find some safety, some caring. You've got only a few choices. Kill yourself, go crazy, kill someone else. Potts had no one, no way to survive.
Barry paused, took my head in her hands, and more seriously than I'd ever seen her, said,
"Roy, you're a survivor. You'll make it now, to bear witness, to record the ones who didn't survive."
All across the country, interns were killing or going crazy, trying to survive. The medical hierarchy would continue. The new residents would say to the new interns, "We did it, now you do it." It was the scaly underside of the American medical dream. It was Nixon in these edited transcripts, shocking Americans with, "I don't give a shit what happens, I want you to stonewall it." And it was my own arrogance in the face of the most feeling human events, a loved one's sickness, a loved one's suffering, a loved one's death. No more. I would not pay the price. Having felt the first tantalizing suckings of this leech, this doctor's disease, I'd burn the fucker off.
"How?" "I'm here, Roy. Don't shut me out. I care, and your friends care, too. Sharing the experience is what will get all the rest of you through."
"Fats!" I cried out, apprehensive, worried that by fighting with him in Gomer City and by avoiding him while in the unit, I'd wrecked something with him. I got up. I had to see him right away and tell him. "Gotta see the fat man," I said, heading for the door. "Gotta tell him before it's too late."
"It's 3 a.m., Roy. What do you want to tell him?"
"That I'm sorry. And that I like him. And thanks."
"He won't like it if you wake him in the middle of the night."
"Yeah. Damn," I said, sitting back down. "I hope that there's still time."
"There will be. There always is, with people like him."
That was a beginning. To repair, to recreate the human, took some time. And it wasn't for many months, no, years, that I was free from a recurrent nightmare. Strapped down upon an icy metal slab, writhing back and forth to break free, running and running and running away in a marathon race from death. As I began to repair, I asked myself what had been missing. From another time, another almost tropical country plagued by civil war, like a man with his chest thrown out proudly toward a firing squad who thinks back to a clear young summer and a gilded, beribboned love letter ringed with doves, I realized that what had been missing was all that I loved. I would be transformed. I'd not leave that country of love again. Chapter 23. "What are you going to do on July the 1st? I asked Chuck.
"Who knows, man? Who knows? All I know is I don't want to do no more of this."
It was May Day. I was in the on-call room of my final ward rotation, 4 South. I was lying in the top bunk. This was unusual. The turn always used the bottom bunk, so he wasn't at risk of going to ground from the orthopedic height and breaking his hip. For some reason, I'd had the urge to lie in the top bunk, up under the ceiling, far back from the leading edge. I'd gathered pillows, climbed the ladder, and settled into a peaceful horizontality, snuggled up against the back wall, staring at the pea-green, sea-green ceiling. Very nice. I wished that the top bunk had side rails, like a Gomer bed or crib. I wished food. A breast. A nipple. Why not? There I was to stay. Others would try to move me, and at times others would succeed, but I had work to do. Having recognized the doctor's disease, I wasn't sure that I could escape. Oh, yes, I had work to do. On compassion. On love. Like a park attendant with a steel-tipped stick, I had to patrol the darkening seaside summer park, browsing around the bandstand in the wake of the wedding, stabbing, collecting the shredded scraps of self
scattered through the rainbow of confetti, ruffled in the breezes from the bay. From my top bunk, I could see in through the windows of the fleshed-out wing of Zoc. With the spring, the workers seemed renewed, and in the plush GI radiology suite across from me, imitation gold toilet fixtures lay scattered on the thick green carpet like mushrooms. This pristine wing of Zoc offered hope for the house of God, for the people. My hope was to finish the year in one piece. On July the 1st, the medical profession acknowledged its only game, musical jobs. You had to play this game in advance. All of us turns in the house of God had tacitly agreed not only to the one-year turnship, but to the second year as residents. For some of us, like Howie, this was terrific. 2 years of being a real doc being twice as good as one. Smiling, puffing, Howie seemed to love the turnship. Cautious, indecisive, Howie was acknowledged to be the worst turn. Terrified of harming patients or of taking risks, he practiced a homeopathic, almost phantom, medicine. "You know," I said to Chuck, "that dose of antibiotic Howie was giving that woman downstairs is like giving a millionth of an aspirin. It's like pissing in the wind, man, is what it is. It's amazing, though. He's still happy in Gomer City." "Impossible." "No, it ain't. I came in this morning, and Howie was whistling. He went in there a month ago, whistling, and he's still whistling, puffing that pipe and whistling. They won't break that dude, no way. He loves it." Others of us felt differently. Hooper, Eddie, the Runt, Chuck, and I clung together in our disillusionment. Having agreed to do another year come July the 1st, we were sure of one thing. We did not want to do another year in the house of God. None of us knew what to do. What would we say to Lego when he called us in to ask us, thinking he already knew the answer, what were our plans for July the 1st? The 2 months to decide were to be spent on Ward 4 South with Chuck and the resident, a shade named Leon. Leon, finishing 2 years in the house, had perfected the technique of the LP, low profile. Leon's profile was so low that no one saw him. Ever. Having watched people screw up their life plans at the house by being visible, Leon had perfected invisibility. Slim, common-featured, commonly and neatly dressed, Leon reckoned on only 2 more months of LPing it until musical jobs and the ultimate city, Phoenix, the ultimate fellowship, dermatology. On 4 South, outside myself, only the most extraordinary could hold my interest. The extraordinary took shape in 789 and Olive O. 789 was my new BMS. A mathematician who'd gone to Princeton, and who'd done his senior honors thesis on the numeral 789, he'd been nicknamed by Chuck and me 789, or, for short, Sev. A bepimpled intellectual prodigy with few social skills, just the kind of draft pick the BMS adored, 789 always had a scared rabbit look in his eyes. A rare genius for numbers, he was a dullard in common sense. His body coordination was beneath contempt, and all but the most lock-stout Gomers soon banished him from doing any procedure upon their bodies. Olive O was just as rare. Olive O was a Gomer extraordinaire who'd been turfed to the house in some secrecy by her family. Told by flunky Marvin in admitting that there was a turf from orthopedics, I'd sent Sev to investigate. Sev had looked through Olive's chart, had talked to the surgical resident, and had found out that for some godforsaken reason, the surgeons, overcome with an early summer cutting zeal, had made Olive the proud recipient of a hemipelvectomy. They had ripped off half her pelvis, which had left her with only one leg. They had used the orthodox turf tool from surgery, replacing too little blood, which had made Olive the proud recipient of an MI and in need of medical care. Proudly showing me a series of EKG traces,
Sev explained to me, with vector diagrams and with herds of those imaginary numbers that had outgrazed my IQ in grade 11, how he had succeeded in obtaining an electrophysiologically sound EKG using three of Olive's extremities, the fourth being in a can in the morgue. How could I fail to have been impressed? Sev and I, proud son, proud father, went on down to Ortho. Tied down in her personal Ortho jungle gym of rods, poles, bells, and chains, lay our Olive. A nest of white hair cradled her balding head. Eyes shut, breathing calmly, whitely, she was reveling in her penultimate stillness. From the top of her head to the tip of her 10 toes, she was at peace. 10 toes? I uncovered her feet further and counted toes. 10. I counted feet. 2. Legs? 2. I brought Sev to the bedside, and together the little polymath and I counted. All right, now we count legs. 1.
I don't think that's funny, said Sev. I know how to count.
Well then, what happened?
I got the wrong chart.
You didn't look at this patient?
Yes, I did, said Sev. I looked. I just didn't see the other leg, that's all. My cognitive set was for one leg, not for two.
Terrific, I said. Reminds me of a very famous house law. Show me a BMS who only triples my work, and I will kiss his feet. The rareness of Olive was her humps. As I did my brief incursion into the realm of her body, I noticed under the bedsheets two protrusions from the vicinity of her chest belly. Curious, I fantasized about what they might be. Breasts? Hardly. Supranumerary growths? No. I rolled down the sheet and rolled up her nightie, and there they were, sprouting from her abdomen below her low-slung flat breasts, were two humps. Sev, at the foot of the bed, enjoying the luxury of putting EKG leads on both legs, glanced up, and his eyes lit up with horror, and he blurted out,
"Ugh! What are those things?
What do they look like?"
"Humps."
"Good, Sev, good. That's what they are."
"I've never heard of humps in humans. What's in them?"
"Don't know," I said, seeing my own disgust mirrored in 789's eyes. "But by God, we're going to find out." And I began to examine them.
"Ugh," said Sev. "Excuse me, but I feel, yeah."
I watched him rush out of the room. I, too, felt repulsed, vomitoid. And that, Bash, is what you've learned this year in the House of God. When you feel like vomiting, you don't. Later, in the on-call room, Sev had come up to me and apologized for getting sick, and I told him it was understandable and that he never had to confront the humps again. I was surprised to hear him say,
"Yes, but I'd like to work them up."
"The humps? I thought they made you sick."
"They did, but I'll take an antiemetic if I have to. Doggone it, Dr. Bash, I'm going to work up those humps. You just wait and see."
"Suit yourself," I said, in spite of the fact that you couldn't tell how many legs or toes she had, Sev. "From this day on, she's all yours."
"I don't know how to say this, Dr. Bash, but, well, thanks. Thanks a lot.
I'll need a prescription for Compazine." And who were we, anyway, to imagine we knew what these Gomers felt, to be so hot on saving them? Wasn't it ridiculous for us to imagine that they felt as we did? As ridiculous as it would be for us to try to imagine what a child felt? We were putting into these Gomers our fear of death. But who knew if they feared death? Perhaps they welcomed death, like a dear, long-lost cousin, grown old, but still known, coming to visit, relieving the loneliness, the failing of the senses, the fury of the half-blind looking into the mirror and not recognizing who was looking back. A dear friend, a dear reliever, a healer who would be with them for an eternity. The same eternity as the long ago, before birth. Wouldn't that be death for them?
"You know, Roy, I want to be so rich,"
said Chuck. That's it. Maybe in July I'll start one of them equal opportunity foundations to find out why we're such good guys, and nobody else is, huh?
Do you really hate medicine? I asked.
Well, man, put it this way. I know I hated this.
A sloth from transportation poked his nose in, delivering the mail. I picked up a throwaway journal called Doctor's Wife, addressed to Mrs. Roy G. Bash. Chuck looked at his mail. His eyes lit up, and he said,
Damn! It just happened again!
What did?
The postcards! Here, look,
he said, and handed me a postcard. Want to have a lucrative practice on Nob Hill, San Francisco? If so, fill out and return this card. I left the House of God and drove to the suburbs. I stopped in front of a large turreted Victorian house, opened the door, and suddenly realized why the fat man had never let me see his house before. I was in a crowded waiting room. The first floor was his office. The fat man had a booming private practice in general medicine. The receptionist greeted me, said that Fats was a little behind schedule and led me past a lab and an examining room to what seemed to be a workshop. There I sat, waiting. I couldn't help noticing the signs of many abandoned projects, and in one corner was a pile of lenses and stainless steel tubing and hand-lettered slogans, Own Your Own Asshole. Gay assholes, gray assholes, assholes of foreign wars, and finally the conundrumical, some of my best friends are assholes. How goes the anal mirror? I asked as he came in.
Ah, yes, said Fats dreamily. Dr. Jung's. An idea whose time might just have come, eh, Bash? If only I had the time.
What's keeping you so busy?
Diarrhea.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Not mine, the vets. Haven't you heard?
No, I said, thinking this would be a way to introduce what I'd planned to say. No, we've been out of touch. That's why I insisted on...
Yeah, over a month. So much has happened. Back then, I was on the ropes, not knowing if I'd get my fellowship letter from the Lego.
Yeah, I said, trying to stick with my feelings. I wanted to tell...
Where do you hear what's been going on, Bash? Oh, Christ, where do you hear about this?
Settling in, he began to tell me how, like one of those weighted clowns that you punch down and watch bob back up, he'd rebounded with a smile. But then he noticed the anxious look on my face and stopped.
You've come to say you're sorry. Is that it?
How had he known? Looking into those familiar dark eyes, I felt choked up. Ashamed, I blushed. My face twisted toward sadness.
I know, said Fats quietly. There'll be time to talk about it. But hey, a guy like me can't wait on telling an old friend new protege about the latest fortuna, can he? Bash, stop sniveling and tune into this. Right now, at this very moment, that diarrhea I inadvertently unleashed is going through God only knows how many hundreds of thousands of U.S. vets' colons, ripping off the mucosal linings and sluicing the villi out through the anus.
The worst! Remember that colonel who cornered you in the unit, snooping around about me?
Yeah, I said, hearing again the colonel asking me all kinds of questions about Fats and Jane Doe's diarrhea, and whether the fat man's extract had cured it. In the midst of our conversation, the colonel had gotten a painful look in his eyes and asked for the men's room. Yeah, I remember the colonel. The one with diarrhea himself.
Exactly. It's all over. NATO, CETO, they say even Tito's caught the goddamn stuff. See, it's a virus.
To date, there's only one cure.
And the one inventor of the one cure is Fats.
You invented a cure?
I invented the disease, so I had to. The extract. A cure not only for the diarrhea, but also for the fat man's GI career.
Musing, he picked up a lens, and toying with it, asked playfully,
Will I, like Lincoln, be the one to bind up our nation's bowels?
I ask you, Bash, as a citizen, is it not time to put this Watergate of diarrhea behind us and go on with the great task of world peace?
How is it a cure for your career?
Oh, well, Lego is a military man, right? And what military man wouldn't jump when a higher-up military man says jump? Why, no one, Bash, no one wouldn't jump at all. You should have seen it. Beautiful. Last week, the Lego and I walked down the corridor together, and there's an arm around my shoulder. There's also an arm around his shoulder, Bash, because in between us is a 6'3", 260-pound gorilla of a 4-star general of the U.S. Army. Made me feel like I'm in a parade in a banana republic. The colonels had won.
So he wrote you a good fellowship letter after all?
Not exactly. Delighted as he was by the promise to the House of a big GI research grant, the Lego has some pride. He told me to write my own letter. He signed it. My fellowship is assured.
Not Hollywood.
Yes, Hollywood. The bowel run of the stars.
I was overwhelmed. Never before had I encountered such sustained application of genius. I felt small. Fats, it's mind-boggling. And you've had this private practice going all year?
Sure. Ever since I got my license last July. What's the sense of being a licensed doc if you don't use it to relieve pain and suffering? This GP work is terrific. These are my neighbors, my people. JFK said it. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country's bowels.
So it all worked out just as you planned.
My life story, Bash. Everything always works out.
Fats, you might think it's stupid, but I did come here to say I'm sorry for fighting with you. And to say thanks.
It's okay, Bash. You don't have to say...
Shut up, you fatso, and listen, I said, smiling, watching him curl down into his roly-poliness and smile sheepishly. You got me through it.
Barry got you through it. Marvelous woman. I wish I had...
Shut up, Fats, I shouted, hurling a piece of an anal mirror at him. Gradually, over the year, I threw away all the others until you were the only one left. When I threw you away last month, things just fell apart.
Now, Roy, said Fats seriously, things fell apart when Eddie cracked and Potts jumped.
None of us stayed on our feet after that.
True.
But you showed me that a guy can stay in medicine and still be himself. That besides the Lego and Putzel, there's another way.
I paused, gathered myself up, and said,
Fats, you're fantastic. Thanks. Thanks for everything.
I fell silent and watched the steady eyes show their happiness. We sat together for a while in silence. Then I sighed and said, The only problem is that your way is not for me. I can't do GI medicine. I doubt if I can stay in medicine at all. It's not for me.
You mean you can't think of an organ you can see yourself dealing with every day for the rest of your life? Fats asked sarcastically.
Kidney? Spleen? Rectum?
Tooth?
My father, the dentist. Unimaginable. Even my grandfather, an immigrant, hadn't stuck himself into anything particular. I remembered my mother telling me about the time her mother took her and my Aunt Lil to watch him, their father, at work. Like a bee in a golden metal honeycomb high up in the sky, they saw him etch the sparkling arcs and curved sunbursts on the spire of the Chrysler Building. At the time, the tallest in the city. Maybe the world. And now, after all these years, I should choose a tooth? Feeling hopeless, I said, I can't see it.
I know. It's clear that it's not for you.
Well, then, what is?
You think I know?
Big deal. Fly high. Have a blast, Bash. Great minds, like ours, can't be just one thing.
Yeah, but I've got to decide soon, I said, feeling lost, cast out, alone, after so many programmed years. I don't know what to do.
Do? Well, in Brooklyn we always did this, said Fats,
and reached out and hooked my pinky in his.
Linking pinkies.
Linking pinkies?
Sure. That's what we did in Brooklyn whenever we didn't know what to do.
A joke? No, his face was serious, sincere. I felt his fat pinky hugging mine. Suddenly, I knew what he meant. It was perfect. A magical moment. A tingling current of feeling zinged through me. He'd sensed my emptiness, and he'd responded. His touch meant I wasn't alone. He and I were connected. I squeezed back. It was love. No matter what, Fats and I would be friends. Laughing, I said, "You know, for a fat kid, you don't sweat much."
"Right, life's tough, but even a fat kid can fast on Yom Kippur."
Barry and I were laughing over the lead article in Doctor's Wife, a tribute to a terrific doctor's wife who, becoming aware of the depth charges in a doctor's dinner, such as her terrific doctor hubby getting called out on an emergency case that might keep him away until his food gets cold, had learned a foolproof operation to keep roast beef deliciously rare for hours, namely wrapping it in aluminum foil and warming it on a hot plate. I told Barry about my top bunk posture and asked if she thought it was another regression. "No, I think it's integration, working out what to do with yourself. Now that you know you can be a doctor, you've got the option of discarding medicine and moving on. What are you thinking of doing?"
"Going on vacation to France with you. Maybe taking a year off."
"But what are you going to tell the Lego about July?"
"I don't know. I hated this. The whole year sucked."
"Not true. Fats, the policemen, your buddies, you liked them. And you liked listening to your patients in the clinic, right?"
"As long as I didn't have to do anything medical, it was fun."
"In the EW, you were fascinated by the psych resident, Cohen." Tantalizingly, she asked, "Why not become a psychiatrist?"
"Me?" I said, surprised. "A shrink?"
"You." Looking me squarely in the eyes, she said, "Being with people was all that kept you going this year, Roy, and being with is the essence of psychiatry." Click. In my head, click. I asked her to repeat what she'd said. "Being with is the essence of psychiatry. You've always perched yourself at a slight angle to the universe. Psychiatry might be perfect for you." "Being with." Click. Dr. Sanders, dying, telling me that what doctors did was to be with patients.
"You mean being with patients?"
"I mean being with," she said, "even being with your family."
"Family?"
"My grandfather, turfed to rot in a home, never again to be with anyone." "My father?"
"There is nothing more comforting during illness than a loved one to be with you, and a good physician can serve that role."
"You're saying that psychiatry really offers something to patients? That it's different from medicine in that you can cure?"
"Sometimes.
If you catch a life early, yes."
"So the big thing is that you can offer something to patients."
"No, you can offer something to yourself." Stunned, I asked her, "What can you offer to yourself?"
"Growth.
Instead of forgetting, you'd try to remember. Instead of defensive, obsessive superficiality, you'd try to become open, looser, deep. You'd create. Your only tool as a therapist is who you are and who you might become." It was hard for me to think. Somehow, in the chaos, something was clearing. I might become someone I might not despise? Escape being strapped into the rocker of past? Culling my memories for trinkets? Be rid of my avoiding, my exploding, my contempt? Trembling, I asked her if there was anything I could start to read.
"Freud. Start with Mourning and Melancholia.
In it, Freud says, the shadow of the lost object falls across the ego. You've been under that shadow for a solid year. What shadow? You. The shadow of yourself. My lacuna of humanity. My Barry. How I'd grown to love her, my accepting, caring, clear-sighted, soft one, during this abrasive year. I love you, I said. I've lived through this nightmare because you were with me. Yes, partly. And you're right. This internship has been like the stuff of dreams, like the overpowering nightmares of childhood. Aggression, fear of retaliation, and then the resolution, where you don't win, you live. It's the straight edible theme, mother, father, child.
Hope you are finishing up well and glad to be finished with your experience. Could not understand your premise that now you can handle all medical problems and there is so much to know. I am very worried over the worldwide economic situation, meaning the inability of the brains of the world to solve inflation and the monetary crisis, and it is not even worth having money in the bank. I don't know what Mother told you, but I know it was basic and true. I know you care for us as a son, and that will never change. Distance and circumstance have interfered with our keeping close, and that is inevitable in this day and age. Would love to play golf with my son number one again, and that is just a hope. Mom really has such a short, controlled swing, and it is a picture. My passion for the game is unlimited, and I do enjoy it.
Chapter 24. Disillusioned, not wanting to go on as house residents, but not knowing what to do, we needed help. We turned to Fats. At the 10 o'clock meal, we asked him what we should do.
About what?
About what specialty to go into on July the 1st.
Do what's always done nowadays, said Fats. Do a colloquium. Never fails.
What on? Asked Eddie, his eyes a bit dull. Tranquilized.
On how to choose a specialty. What else?
Who the hell's gonna run it? Asked the runt.
Who? Asked Fats, smiling.
Me. The star of the bowel run of the stars.
Word spread quickly. On the day, from all over the House of God, turns and BMSs appeared. Even Gilheeny and Quick were there. The crowded room hushed, and the fat man began.
The whole pattern of medical education is backwards. By the time we realize we're not going to be TV docs, undressing ripe-titted beauties, but rather house docs disimpacting gomers, we've invested too much to quit. And we wind up like you poor slobs. Stuck. The sequence of training should be reversed. On day one, bring the puking BMSs right into the House of God and rub their noses in olive oil. Turn off potential surgeons with her humps, potential internal medicine red hots with her numbers incompatible with life and her inability to be cured or dead. Even potential gynecologists will take one look at the terrain of their future specialty and transfer into dentistry. And then, and only then, let the ones who still have the stomach for it start on the preclinical years.
It was brilliant, as expected. But how did it help us now?
But that doesn't help you now, because now you've invested, and now you're trapped.
So?
So there are many different specialties you could choose. Most of them involve the same close contact you've had with patients all this year. Touching, being tortured, killing yourself with night call. These are the PC, patient care, specialties. PC specialties will not be considered here. The masochists may leave.
No one left.
I myself am going into a PC specialty. Gastroenterology. I have my reasons. I am a very special case. Where I'm headed, GI is what's best for me. A rare gift, eh?
Right.
But the NPC, no patient care, specialties, number 6, and only 6. Rays, gas, path, derm, ophthalmology, and psychiatry.
The fat man listed these six on the blackboard, and told us he would list, with our suggestions, the advantages and disadvantages of each. Game theory, he called it. This chart would optimize our specialty choice. First, said Fats, is rays. Advantages of radiology?
Money, said Chuck. Big money.
Exactly, said Fats. A veritable fortuna. Other advantages? Aside from the assumed no patient care, no one could think of any other advantages. And Fats asked for disadvantages.
Gomers, I said. You do bowel runs on gomers.
Narcolepsy, said Hooper. You're always in the dark.
Gonads, said the runt. X-rays can fry your sperm. Your first kid comes out with one eye, two teeth, and eight fingers to a hand.
Terrific, said Fats, writing them down.
Men, we're on our way.
We proceeded to construct a table of the NPC specialties. Specialty. Rays. Advantages, money. 100K per annum. Disadvantages, gomers. Dark offices. Narcolepsy. Damaged gonads. Eight-fingered progeny. Barium enemas. And bowel runs. Specialty. Gas. Advantages, money. 100K per annum. Disadvantages, gomers. Boredom punctuated by panic. Astronomical malpractice premiums. Noxious gases producing bizarre personalities. Contempt, daily, of surgeons. Specialty, path. Advantages, no live bodies. Low malpractice premiums. Disadvantages, gomers, rare. Dead bodies. Smell of dead bodies and formalin-type picklers. Basement office. Contempt, daily, of all but other pathologists. Depression. Specialty, derm. Advantages. Money, 100K per annum. Travel to sunny conventions. Naked skin. Attraction. Disadvantages. Gomers. Contagion. Naked skin. Repulsion. Specialty, ophthalmology. Advantages, astronomical money, millions per annum. Opportunity daily to torment gas. Disadvantages, gomers, astronomical malpractice premiums, surgical internship required, occasional patient care. Specialty, psychiatry. Advantages, no gomers. Never touch bodies except in sex surrogate therapies. Voyeurism, perversion, eroticism, autoeroticism, polyeroticism. Easy on feet, long lunch hours, cure alleged by Barry. Clinical psychologist and psychotherapist, many others. Disadvantages. Hourly wage. Hard on lumbar spine. Multiple accusations from right-wingers, CF, communist, queer, pervert. Contempt, daily, of other doctors except when they are in therapy. Each specialty has advantage of NPC, no patient care, in the fat man's sense of the term. By the end of the fat man's colloquium, the remarkable had happened. On paper, psychiatry was the clear winner. On the canoe trip, psychiatry loomed even larger. Chuck had organized this final intern outing, and one bright, sweet-breezed summer day we signed out to the house residence, loaded the beer, and headed for the shore, into the foothills of the marshland, to the tidal river, winding through the grasses to the sea. As we paddled lazily downriver, Barry and I found ourselves in a race with the two policemen for last. Gilheeny, a great red-feathered mallard in the bow, continued to curse his ruddermen, quick, as their listing canoe smacked first one bank and then the other. And yet what could have been better than drifting along, drinking cool beer, listening behind us for the deep carmine baritone of the redhead and the insistent tenor of his mate crooning a lament from the Emerald Isle? We stopped on an island for a picnic. In a pine grove dappled with shadow, we found ourselves drawn to Barry. She listened to our discontent. She agreed that the year had been a horror.
It's been inhuman, she said. No wonder doctors are so distant in the face of the most poignant human dramas. The tragedy isn't the crassness, but the lack of depth.